Time to talk some baseball as we welcome in our friend Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal. Hello there, Sean.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was delightful, and as I often do, I spent it in your glorious state, visiting my brother-in-law in Wells, so that made it even nicer.
Excellent. Well, glad to have you in Maine, even for a little while here. Well, baseball, my goodness, the end of the CBA last night to, I guess, nobody's surprise, that expired, and here we are in our first work stoppage in 26 years. What does it all mean?
Well, I think it's going to take a while to sort it out and figure out what it all means, but I think it's safe to say that this thing's going to last a little bit. The owners believe that this was their best tool to put some pressure on the Players Association without directly threatening any loss of games or the regular season. And because of that, I don't think there's much incentive for the two sides to sit down and really get serious about something until probably late January at the earliest, maybe even into early February, and then how long it takes once they decide to be motivated to find a solution is anyone's guess. Obviously, it'll require some concessions on both sides. That's not something that either side likes to do traditionally. Usually, the Players Association has had the upper hand in most of these negotiations. For the most part, the union, that is the Players Association, looks to be very unified. I suspect that won't always be the case with the owners. It is typically not. Sometimes it looks like they're playing a triangular game, where owners are not only matched against the Players Association, but some of their own brethren with large market teams against small market teams. I expect we'll see that divide at some point, with big market teams eager to get a deal done and kind of leave things as they are, and small market teams hoping for, you know, a lowering of the CBT floor, increased revenue sharing, delays to free agency and salary arbitration, all the sort of hot button economic issues.
Well, an interesting time indeed. I find it fascinating. We were talking about this earlier, that it seems like more often than not, fans in these situations side with the owners, picking the billionaires over the millionaires.
Yeah, that's a curious phenomenon to me as well, Rich, and I've written about it quite a bit. I think too many fans are under the mistaken belief that it weren't for those greedy players, box seats at Fenway would again be $7.50. And I'm here to tell you that that is an incorrect notion on your thinking. But I think a lot of it comes down to that sort of idea that a lot of us play baseball as kids and even into young adulthood, and you hear people say all the time, in reference to major league players and their salary demands, you know, I play for free. Well, that may well be true, but guess what? People aren't going to pay to watch you play, whether you're getting paid nothing or millions of dollars. The reason these guys make the money they do is because it's there's a limited number of players or people on this earth who can, we can marginalize and all agree that teachers and policemen and firefighters and others who have much more impact on society should be paid more, and that in theory, baseball players should be paid less. But it's an entertainment area when you get right down to it, and it's about supply and demand. And these guys have unique skills that are not common to most people. They can do things physically and athletically that the vast majority of the public cannot. People enjoy watching them do those things. The owners make a lot of money even after paying the players the salaries they do. I would say this. It is a little hard for both sides to make the claim that things are seriously wrong when you look at the number of the number of contracts given out in the last week. It flies in the face of our games in some sort of crisis, which you know, to varying degrees, both sides are saying, and yet, you know, nearly $2 billion in salary was agreed upon in the last week prior to the lockout. So it's a lot of posturing. You guys know that, and it's going to take a while for that to go away and for them to get down to business, sadly. And you just hope that it's done in time so that they can salvage a manageable spring training that will get the players ready and that the start of the season on March 31st isn't impacted.
We're talking with Sean McAdam here on Downtown. You wrote about it in Boston Sports Journal today. Red Sox owner John Henry, when he's not buying NHL franchises, is very much in the middle of what's going on.
Yeah, that's right. He sits on the owner's labor negotiating committee, and it's my understanding that he has been in the Dallas area for the last few days taking part in this. He has kept a very low profile in terms. It's clear he's not a hawk. He's not a Jerry Reinsdorf or a Dick Monfort from the Colorado Rockies. Reinsdorf used to drive the hawk side of the owners that looked to crush the union and put a cap in and do all these things. And you know, he hit his head against the wall long enough. And now that Jerry's older, he's not nearly as active in these things. Dick Monfort from the Rockies has kind of taken up that mantle from him. I think Henry is quietly more the voice of reason and understands that there's a lot of money to be made here if everyone would just get out of the way. But he's also reluctant to speak about that publicly because the commissioner's office doesn't want to show any you know, any dissent within its ranks or that they're less than unified. So Henry has essentially declined comment on the labor picture, despite, you know, having the opportunity to be very much involved in it.
Well, he's afraid you're going to get him in trouble again, Sean.
Yeah, I wrote today, for those who haven't seen it, that back in 2009, I believe it was, when I was first starting with Comcast Sportsnet New England, now NBC Sports Boston, he told both me and the late Nick Cafardo that he was unhappy that a lot of small market teams were pocketing the revenue sharing money rather than reinvesting it back into their clubs, which is what they're supposed to be doing. And I understand, you know, that's a reasonable point to make. If you're one of the big market teams and you're having to put whatever it is, 30% of your revenue into a pot to be disseminated to the smaller teams like Miami and Pittsburgh and Milwaukee and Kansas City, and some of those teams are taking your money and sticking it in their back pocket and boosting their bottom line rather than trying to get better, I understand that. But Selig did not feel the same way and fined John Henry I think several million dollars for his public dissent. And not surprisingly, since then, he has both half-kiddingly reminded me every time I see him of how much money I cost him. And I'm pretty sure I did not put a gun to his head and ask him to respond to that question, but that's the way he sees it. And he doesn't want to lose any more of his money in the fines from the commissioner's office.
All right, let's talk about some of the deals that were made by the Red Sox here right before everything shut down last night. And let's start with the big one. What's going on with Hunter Renfro for Jackie Bradley Jr.? Are the minor leaguers that good? Is this part of what may eventually become a bigger deal? I like me some JBJ playing the outfield, but, man, Hunter Renfro's coming off a career year.
Yeah, I'm not terribly surprised that they would listen on Renfro. You know, he was taking a big jump, not one that they couldn't afford. He was due about $7.6 million at the salary arbitration table this offseason, and that more than doubles what he was making this year, but that's the nature of arbitration. But I think they thought that that money could be spent in better ways. So I wasn't totally shocked that they would listen and act on moving Renfro. I am more than a little surprised that they would do it in a trade to get Bradley, but of course, I think you hinted at it, Rich. You have to look at this deal beyond Jackie Bradley Jr. the Brewers were desperate to unload his money, more than $12 million for next year. And the Red Sox saw that swap as a way to, not unlike what they did with the Adam Ottavino trade last year, where they took most of his money that the Yankees were trying to dump and got themselves a decent pitching prospect out of him, Frank German, who pitched at Double-A Portland last year. I would say that there are higher-end prospects in this deal. One a corner outfielder with a lot of power potential, the other a middle infielder with speed and defense as his profile. I wouldn't guarantee that Jackie Bradley Jr. is going to be on the Red Sox roster when opening day starts. I think it was a way to move Renfro maybe when his value was highest. And it gives them some options if they do hold on to Bradley. But my sense is they're not done here, both in terms of what they might do with Bradley and what else they're going to do to the outfield. It gives them some options. They could conceivably have both Kike Hernandez and Jackie Bradley in the same outfield with Verdugo in left, and then you have plus defenders in arguably all three spots, because while Verdugo was shaky in center, he played a pretty good left field last year. It may free Kike Hernandez up to move back to the infield, or it may sort of set the stage for the return of Kyle Schwarber, figuring that, well, if you're going to have Schwarber, who's, you know, below average defensively in the outfield, at least you have Bradley to come off the bench and play late inning defense. It gives you some depth out there. So there are a number of ways that they could go from this. I'm pretty sure though that they're not done, both as a, you know, in terms of roster building and maybe even in retaining Bradley.
I love the pickup of Rich Hill. And did I read last night somewhere along the way that this is the seventh time he's been signed as a free agent by the Red Sox?
Yeah, I mean, some of that is a little misleading because it was all like one stint for, he did 3 years back around 2010. Then he came back for another year or so and then missed a year because of more physical issues, but it is his third time back with the Red Sox, totaling a number of about five or six seasons. You know, he's a local guy, as you may have heard once or twice. He's one of those guys who has his hometown of Milton almost attached to his name. It's always Milton's Rich Hill. He now lives in Southie. He's got, you know, a young family that he would like to not uproot. He wanted, I think, to be here last year, and it didn't work out. He ended up going to Tampa, getting traded to the Mets, and, you know, with an opportunity to and some openings in the rotation, it was a good fit. You know, he may be going to be 42 when next season starts, but if you look at what he did last year, he pitched more innings than anybody in the Red Sox rotation other than Nathan Eovaldi.
Right.
He made more starts than anybody other than Nathan Eovaldi. And he had an ERA under four for something like the seventh consecutive season. So, look, he's not going to give you seven and eight inning starts, but those guys are pretty rare in Major League Baseball these days anyway. You know, they could conceivably go with this rotation of, say, Sale, Eovaldi, Pivetta, and Waka and Hill, knowing that maybe the back three guys are only going to give you four innings and change, five innings and change, and leave both Houck and Whitlock as kind of multi-inning bridge guys to get you from, you know, the fifth to the eighth inning two or three times a week. So again, flexibility and versatility are the buzzwords here. I wouldn't be surprised if they went for one more established starter, whether that's through free agency or maybe a trade. But if they have to start the way with what they have, leaving those two guys in the bullpen to provide multi-inning relief appearances, there would be worse rotations than the one they have now.
And I like the signing of James Paxton. It seems like a classic low-risk, high-reward move.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they're going to pay him $6 million guarantee in 2022, even though he probably won't be ready to pitch until August. He's on about the same timetable that Chris Sale was this past year. So you kind of overpay for him to rehab this season and then, you know, hope that he contributes over the final 2 months and maybe into the postseason. And then you've got him at a reasonable number for each of the next 2 years. In a worst-case scenario, it doesn't work out. You pay him $6 million for, you know, 7 or 8 starts this year. You pass on the team option. He could then exercise a player option for 2023 at $4 million. And if you really don't want him, you release him, and you've lost $10 million over 2 years. So, again, it's kind of low-risk, high-reward there.
And I love the fact that Kevin Plawecki's back. We haven't seen this bigger reaction for a backup catcher since the police were escorting Doug Mirabelli to Fenway.
Yeah. You know, he's fit into that role comfortably, the backup catcher. And that's, you know, that's not always an easy job to handle. And I don't know that he's ever going to be a guy that could grow into a number one. He was thought to be that guy, you know, when he was making his debut into pro ball. But defensively, he doesn't throw real well. He's adequate defensively. He gives you a little bit of pop. But he's a guy that, you know, is ready a couple times a week and can come off the bench and pinch hit here and there. The pitchers like throwing to him. Evaldi paired with him particularly well last season. So, you know, it's one of those things where you don't go out to make a priority of finding a number two catcher. But when you have one who understands what's being asked of him, it can be a pretty valuable piece to the puzzle on a 26-man roster.
Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal getting us caught up on the shutdown, the lockout to the Red Sox, and much more. Sean, appreciate it. As always, if we don't talk to you before then, hope you and your family have a very Merry Christmas, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Same to you and all your people there, Rich, and your listeners as well. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas to everybody, and always great being on with you.
All right. Thank you, Sean. Sean McAdam with us on Downtown.